Right, well, I'd of course like to thank the organisers for inviting me to this workshop. It's been a very stimulating week so far, and I've really enjoyed seeing all the talks in this area. I feel like my talk is going to be repeating a lot of material that you've already seen, and so I've kind of felt like my talk's been shrinking as the week goes on, but it's Thursday morning. Hopefully this will be a nice gentle recap of a lot of the concepts you're familiar with. And if I have time, then I'd actually like to try and give a second talk on my other area of research, which will just be a brief overview of the connection between two-dimensional tilings and three-dimensional networks, because there's lots of really interesting topological questions there, which I think you might find interesting as well. Okay. So, all right, just a little bit about the group I'm working with. I'm in Applied Maths at the Australian National University in Canberra, and I think I'm the only person in the department with a formal mathematics degree. Everybody else comes from engineering or physics or chemistry, and of course there's people working in high performance computing and visualization as well. So it's a very interdisciplinary group. We have experimental labs, and one of those labs runs an X-ray CT facility. So the sorts of images they're interested in collecting are from porous materials. And a couple of examples here. Is this the laser pointer? Yep. So a couple of examples here. This one's the result of a drainage experiment. So they've started with a cylinder full of little plastic beads, filled it up with water, and then let that water drain out. And what we've imaged here is the water that remains. So the little films of water that surround the contacts between the beads. So you can see there's all sorts of, oh, nice topology going on there. This second movie is an image of bone that is regrown into a polymer scaffold. So the transparent space is the polymer scaffold, and the structure you're seeing is the bone that's regrown. So you can see there's lots of interesting structure there on many different length scales, and we'd like to be able to quantify and characterise the sort of structure that we're seeing. The pictures down the bottom here are examples of foamed materials. This is what is called an open cell foam, for obvious reasons. This second image is supposed to be a closed cell foam, so that they're supposed to be isolated voids, but you can see there's lots of defects there, either due to manufacture or possibly the imaging. And on the left is a random foam material. So the sort of question we're looking at... Yeah, it's a material. It's a genuine... So I guess the blue stuff with the orange interface would be some sort of polymer that's been turned into a foam. Okay, so this gets used in all sorts of industries. And this open cell foam, again, would be some sort of polymer in the struts. So we'd be interested in, to a topologist, right, the open cell foam has lots of beta 1. The closed cell foam should have lots of beta 2. And this random foam is probably going to have a little bit of both. And so we might like to use these topological measures, the Betty numbers, as a way to quantify the type of foam or the quality of the foam, for example. Okay. Now, these images are all quite old, so I'll just show you a more recent image to give you a better idea of the quality that my colleagues can achieve. So this is an image of a sandstone. This is just a slice through the tomogram. And this is a close-up of that region. So you can see we're getting really very high resolution. It's a very large image. And the point I wanted to make here was that our ability to image has increased exponentially in the past 50 years. Our ability to compute has also increased exponentially. And thankfully, our computational abilities have increased, outpaced our imaging abilities. So people are really seeing a genuine increase in the usefulness of quantitative image analysis. So being able to do a real space geometric and hopefully topological analysis on this sort of data. Oh yeah, so for example, for this particular example, the money's coming from the oil industry. So this is a sandstone core from an oil field, and people want to understand the structure of the pore space, because that's going to help people to understand how much oil you can actually get out of that rock. Okay, so there's but this also is of interest in soil science, aquifers. I think the voxel resolution is about 2 or 3 microns, or that would be the very best images. So it's tens of microns. Okay, so you can see we're getting very large three-dimensional images. They have very intricate structure on many length scales. There's always going to be a bit of noise. Noise is a result of a trade-off between image acquisition time and image quality. And the sorts of things that we want to be able to do with these images are segmentation, for example. So segmentation means deciding which voxels come from which different phases in the image. A very naive approach to segmentation is just to take a threshold on the grayscale values. But of course, because of noise and reconstruction artifacts, that's never going to give you the right answer or the best answer. So segmentation is really, there's quite an art to that, and there's a lot of ongoing research into good algorithms for coming up with the best segmentations. For this porous materials, where we want to be able to study fluid flow through the pore space, connectivity is vitally important. If you get the connectivity of the pore space wrong, then you're going to get all your flow simulations are going to be incorrect. The other type of problem that I referred to in the first slide is object characterization. So once you have a segmented image, we want to be able to quantify the type of structure that we're seeing there. And we may do that via Euclidean distance transforms. So that just means take a function on the binary image, which measures the distance from each voxel to the boundary between black and white. And this allows you to define things like the medial surface or medial axis. And our hope, of course, is to be able to basically do persistent homology on these types of things. All right. Well, for example, with the foams, it would tell you, all right, if you could compute persistent homology, it would tell you about the type of cell structure that you're seeing, and because persistent homology is going to depend both on geometric parameters and the topological parameters, it should help you quantify the strength of the material, or it may that people are seeing connections between. There's a lot of network modeling that's been done on this fluid flow, and you can relate topological parameters of the network, like vertex degree and connectivity, with the fluid yield, for example. So it's a hope that we can use these topological measures to correlate with physical properties of the material. Okay, well, I hardly need to explain more theory to everybody here, but the base, the element that we're the element of Morse theory that we're interested in is the way that critical cells connect up into a complex. So this is actually something that people in the image analysis community have kind of known about without really knowing that they know about it. So for example, the two cell here that's associated with a maximum is something that people in image analysis know as the watershed basin, okay? And the boundaries here are the watershed complex. And the other construction from image analysis that people are familiar with is the contour tree, which is basically just a merge tree between different components. So that is effectively a tree on the minima and the saddles. And so what this Morse complex gives us is a broader theoretical framework to understand watersheds and component trees. And of course, the other thing we want to be able to do is persistent homology. You've already seen a few talks about this. And the nice thing about persistent homology is that it is able to pair the creation of cycles, with their filling in. So here we create a cycle when we add the edge AB, and that cycle is eventually filled in by that triangle. Okay. So in order to do persistent homology, we need a cell complex of some sort. So our original idea was to be able to maybe use digital topology algorithms such as the watershed complex to build a nice summary of the structure in an image and then be able to do persistent homology. But of course, the devil is always in the details, and it took us about a year of trying different algorithms from digital topology before we realized that none of them were really going to give us the right answer, and we had to come up with our own solution. So this is it. So we eventually realized, as I know a lot of other people in the audience here appreciate, is that you need to look at your image as a cubical complex. So we're going to treat voxels as the vertices in a cubical complex, and we'll be looking at the lower level cuts. So the lower level cut will be all cells with vertices less than a particular threshold value. So in our picture here, if we take the level cut at voxel value 5, so that's voxel value 5, this is what our cubical complex is going to look like. And if we now grow that into the cubical complex at level 6, we do that by adding what's called the lower star. So this is the voxel with value 6. Its lower star consists of 2 squares and 3 edges. So we want an algorithm that's going to let us detect when there's been a topological change between these two level sets. Okay, so let's... the basic ingredients in this algorithm start with simple homotopy. So the fundamental notion in simple homotopy is that of a free pair. So a cell has a free face when a face that's codimension 1 has no other co-faces. So this cell beta actually has 3 free faces. When we choose a particular pair between a cell and its free face, we can remove them from the complex without changing the homotopy type. All right. So we can make a sequence of these elementary collapses, and the inverse of a collapse is an expansion. So this is the basic idea on how to, like, this is enough machinery to allow us to detect when a voxel is simple, so when adding or removing a voxel does not change the homotopy type. But of course, we want to be able to detect when there has been a topological change, and to identify critical cells, and the way to do that is to use discrete Morse theory, as formulated by Robin Forman. So the fundamental object in discrete Morse theory is a function defined on each cell in the complex, and such that one of these three conditions holds. So if we pick a particular cell, it either has a single coface with a lower value, or it has a single face with a higher value. And if neither of those two cases hold, then all the faces of alpha take strictly lower values, all the faces co-faces take higher values, and alpha will be critical. So it's much easier to see this in terms of pictures. This example here is on the right is not a Morse function because, for example, this one cell has two faces which are higher, of higher value. The function on the left is a Morse theory, is a Morse function. And so, for example, the vertex with function value 0 is a critical cell because its two co-faces are both strictly higher. Edge 2 has a single face with a higher value, so we pair those two cells and we represent that pair with an arrow. Okay. So there's a nice connection between these arrows are going to be the way we define this discrete vector field, and the connection between with simple homotopy theory is that if we look at level cuts on the complex according to this Morse function, then the level cuts grow in simple homotopy pairs. So as we go from level cut to level cut, we're either adding cells that appear as pairs like this in a simple homotopy expansion, or we're adding a critical cell. And that critical cell represents a change in the topology. So this is exactly what we want to be able to detect. This is just definitions of the gradient field. So the point is that a Morse function defines a gradient, discrete gradient vector field, so there's no loops in that vector field. And the other big result from Forman is that if we follow these paths in the discrete vector field, then they give us a chain complex that allows us to compute homology. All right. So this is what we want. Now, our image is a function on our cubical complex, but we only have values on the vertices, all right? And we want to be able to go from this function defined on the vertices to a function defined on the entire cubical complex. So we're going to grow. For our applications, we're going to assume that each voxel takes a different value. If that's not the case, we can perturb it with just a very small linear ramp function. It's just a way of getting a strict ordering on the voxels. So as long as you can define a strict ordering on the voxels, then our algorithm will work. We're going to grow the level cuts of the cell complex one lower star at a time. So when we get to voxel 6, we're just going to add those cells from the lower star. And this makes our algorithm fully parallelizable because we can treat each voxel and its lower star independently. And within each lower star, we're going to grow with simple homotopy expansions wherever possible. If we can no longer find a free pair to grow the lower star, then we add a critical cell. All right, so there's the algorithm taken from our paper. I'm sure that's all crystal clear to you. But perhaps a picture would help. So the implementation of the algorithm is based on these two priority queues. PQ0 contains cells from the lower star that have no unpaired faces, and PQ1 has cells with exactly one unpaired face. All right, and the priority queues are ordered according to some ranking function. This ranking function can be anything really, but we've been using a decreasing list of the cells' vertices. So, all right, the first thing the algorithm does is basically pair the vertex with its lowest edge. So that's represented here. Once we've made that pairing, we look at neighbors of that edge to see if they have a single unpaired face, and if they do, then we add that to PQ1. So that's what. So then we look at PQ1, we see who's at the top of PQ1, and we take that pair between the cell and its single free edge to make another expansion. And after that iteration, we look at neighbors of the cells to see if there's any more candidates for simple homotopy expansion, and then keep growing incrementally like that. Now, all the pictures I've given you so far have been for 2D because that's the easiest way to represent things, but of course, this algorithm and the proofs has all been designed to work on 3D images. So here's a three-dimensional example. So the voxel that we're adding is voxel 8 here, and the lower star is these three faces and one edge. Okay. So the algorithm proceeds by pairing the voxel with its lowest edge, 8-1, and after that there are no adjacent faces with three edges, so we have to look at the priority Q0, so all the edges here have no unpaired faces, and we choose one as a critical edge. So in order to go to this next step, we've had to add a critical edge. So we now look at neighbors of that critical edge. It's got two squares that neighbor it with a single free edge each. So we take the lowest of that and we grow that pair, and so on. So eventually we've ended up adding a critical edge and a critical two cell to this lower star. And I think this ability to add two critical cells with a single voxel is quite an important step in the digital topology community, because up until now, in digital topology, people have been able to identify simple voxels, ones where you don't change topology, and then they've lumped in together, basically, all the other voxels where topology does change. So maybe they've been able to designate a simple minimum or a simple maximum, but these voxels where there's been more than one type of topological change happening haven't been very well understood. So I really feel this simple homotopy, discrete Morse theory algorithm acting on the lower star has really given a good and robust definition of topological changes in digital images. Okay. So now we've defined our discrete vector field and our critical cells, we can build the Morse complex. So basically this involves identifying a critical cell and following V paths until they hit another critical cell. So this is just a graph traversal algorithm. Once you get this chain complex, you can use it to do compute persistent homology. So there's some little examples of that in our paper. Since we're all mathematicians here, I get to talk about the proof that this algorithm is actually correct. So what I mean by correct is that in growing this lower star, our algorithm doesn't introduce any extra critical cells. Okay. So the critical cells that the algorithm identifies are exactly the type that we need to reflect the change in the topology between the two lower cuts. And the way the proof proceeds is just to use the Meyer-Vittoris sequence to show that any change in homology between successive lower level cuts is signaled by the presence of a non-bounding cycle in the lower link. So lower link is where the lower star meets the lower level cut. So that's the orange cells there. And we then make an equivalence between our algorithm and an algorithm that acts on the lower link, and prove that that algorithm cannot create any extra critical cells. Okay. So I'll just discuss one application we've been looking at. This is still fairly preliminary work, the actual applications. So what we've got here is a little piece of sandstone. It's been a cleaned up and segmented image. So the dark area represents the rock, and the transparent area represents the pore space. And we're going to look at the Euclidean distance transform on this object. So distances inside the rock are going to be negative, and distances into the pore space will be positive. And we can use that if we build the Morse complex from that Euclidean distance map, then we know that all the maxima have to occur inside the rock, and we can. So if we just leave out those three cells, so any cell in the cubical complex that's simple homotopy equivalent through an expansion to that maximum, we'll just ignore, and what's left behind are these sheet-like structures and one-dimensional structures. So this is a kind of generalized notion of a medial surface. And what's interesting to the porous materials people is that this medial surface is very sheet-like, and so it's not going to be well represented by a network model, for example. Because a lot of the work they've been doing so far has been trying to thin the pore space down into a one-dimensional network, but that's not always going to be a good representation of the pore space. And so we're hoping that with this generalized idea of a Morse medial surface, we'll be able to get better descriptions of those pore spaces. Okay.
Do you have calculated something about this shape?
Not this shape directly, but other objects we've been able to compute the persistent homology of the level cuts.
What does it mean, application? I mean, that application that means you calculate, you finalize the calculation, or you use this calculation for some conclusion, whatever.
Well, the idea will be to use this Morse complex to build. We've used the Morse complex to build this surface, which is a new way to build a type of medial surface. And these medial surfaces are they're useful visualization aids. They also give you ways to summarize the. Well, we've made a geometric conclusion, for example, that this pore space is rather sheet-like instead of network-like. All right. And future directions will be to look at applying Morse cancellation and simplification to these objects. So to get quantify noise and remove noise in a topological way, and also to be able to use topological information when we do image segmentation. So to use topology as a input parameter into image segmentation rather than as something you can only determine afterwards. Mm-hmm.
So, but why are you calling it medial? Because you know the medial is somehow we know as the medial of the existing function. So can you show that this is in the medial?
Yeah, they're because they contain the critical points. So these sheets will contain the saddles. Yeah. Exactly, and the minima. Yeah. But as I say, this is very preliminary stuff, and there's a lot of improvements to be made. And of course, the big theoretical question from is what does this process for a star algorithm do in higher dimensions? So if we, I mean, the algorithm itself will work on any dimensional complex, but the question is, does it give us the correct critical cells? Okay. So my intuition on this is that it's probably going to work, it'll give us a correct answer in four dimensions, but then in higher dimensions, we're going to run into trouble. So I still think it's probably, it will hopefully give a fairly, the minimal number of spurious critical cells in these higher dimensions. Well, I don't, but there's plenty of people around who want to be able to do discrete Morse theory on higher dimensional things. So there's also, there is also four-dimensional image processing, which is dynamic images. So four dimensions is still very interesting in the image analysis community. Higher dimensions from a theoretical perspective, probably, yeah. And, I mean, it's, yeah. The process lower star algorithm will work, I mean, it's going to work on any regular cell complex. So it might be an...
So your algorithm detects the
critical cells. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In a nice way. Phew. So, yeah, any more questions on that sort of thing? This subject? No? Okay, I'm going to switch over, change my hats, and try and give you a very brief overview of... Yeah, yeah, we're about to change subjects. So any more questions about, yeah. Yeah, 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 good, 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 good. Yep. Hang on. There again. Yep. From the beginning? Yep. This one?
Yep.
That's right.
When you apply topological method to the images, do you apply them to the raw data or to the post-processed?
Well, we haven't got any topological okay, so if you apply the topological algorithms to the raw data, you get an awful lot of critical cells, obviously. Okay, so there's a, and we could clean those up using Morse cancellation. So there's a trade-off between how much do you want to do on the topological side and how much do you want to do on the traditional image processing side. So it makes sense with an image like this to do quite a bit of smoothing before you feed it to a topological algorithm, right? But we still have to explore how important is topology to you in the image segmentation. So one of these projects we'll be looking at is yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So to me, the non-persistent homology is already the most non-persistent homology already taken care of.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Smoothing. Exactly. Yeah. 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 But we could test the quality of the smoothing. You could smooth at different levels and see how much the topology changes. Yep.
In your algorithm, when you detect critical points, calculation, you also detect, I mean, you also detect this type of thing and you take all one trajectory or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So the algorithm does this thing at the same time.
Yes, 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 exactly, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When I want to tell people what is topology useful or homology useful, the easiest people, non-mathematician, the easiest way to tell it is, well, if homology can't pop.
Yeah, exactly.
If homology can't figure out.
Yeah, 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 that's a very nice way to say it.
Applications in medical imaging, in particular, one doesn't care about something called, one cares more about precise determination of generators. Length or minimum surface generators, the generators count, not the homology up to an isomorph.
Yeah.
You retrieve generators?
No. I wouldn't say, only through the standard algorithms that are out there. So that's why I've been so interested to see work like yours and other people's. Yeah, that's really good. Yep. Projects is to build a network model from the pore space. So they're interested in identifying a pore and reducing it. So looking at the pore space, trying to reduce it to a one-dimensional network model where the nodes have a volume that's associated with the pore, for example, and the edges between the nodes represent the constriction on the neck between them. And then you can do these invasion percolation models on them and calculate permeability and so on. So the topology of that network is vitally important. So we've done studies to show that if you get the vertex degrees wrong, then that changes the whole percolation behavior. All right. So I guess the idea is to quantify that in a meaningful way. Yeah. Yeah. Well, in some cases, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. So other people are doing direct fluid simulations on the direct image pore space. People are doing that in the group. And the other question is grain partitioning. So if you're looking at the rock phase, trying to say, well, there's a grain of sandstone and there's another little grain of sandstone, and because that's one of the geological measures that people like to have, is the size distribution of the grains and so on, or the size distribution of the pores.
What is relevant about the right picture? There are three colors, white, different of green, two big holes, small holes. This is sort of interesting fact about this picture.
Yeah, I think this is from a fluid flooding image. Not 100% sure. So there's obviously two different phases, I think, in the rock. There could be sandstone and clay, for example, and then the black would be the fluid or the air. Okay, so hopefully I've got 10 minutes now to just show you the beauty of knotted networks. Okay, so this is the other group I work with in applied maths at ANU. Stephen Hyde's the professor there, and he's been paying my way for a number of years. So that's nice. So the main perspective in this project is you can get three-dimensional network structures from two-dimensional tilings. And these types of questions have come out of molecular chemistry, so chemical engineering or crystal engineering. But we're taking a very long step back from the chemistry side of things and just looking as a purely geometric and topological problem. So we can view polyhedra, your classical cubes, tetrahedra, octahedra, dodecahedra, and so on. We can view those as symmetric tilings of the sphere. All right, I'll show you some pictures in a second. And this, so that's a very classical type of picture. And the way we're generalizing that picture is to look at tilings of the plane, for example, wrapped onto the torus. Right, the torus is intrinsically Euclidean. So you can take a tiling of the plane and wrap it either onto a cylinder to get a one-periodic structure or onto the torus to get a finite discrete structure in space. And we can take it another step further, and that's to look at the hyperbolic plane, H2, and we know that the hyperbolic plane can be wrapped onto triply periodic minimal surfaces. And when we do that, we generate periodic nets and also multi-component interwoven things. So I'll just give you a quick tour of these pictures. Here's our polyhedron. Here it is as a tiling of the sphere. Its symmetry group is generated by a reflection through the edges of this triangle. So there's three reflection lines there. That's all I really have to say about the cube. The picture from how we go from the Euclidean plane onto the torus, we take a tiling of the plane, we cut out a translational unit cell as such, and we can either wrap that up onto the cylinder in two different ways possibly, or onto the torus. And we're interested in getting these genuine geometrically embedded objects, okay? Because these objects, as they sit in three-dimensional space, are tangled and knotted, and they have interesting properties, for example. So this example here is a topologically a cube, so that if you look at just the vertex and edge network, it's isomorphic to a cube. But obviously the edges are wrapped and linked and tangled with one another. And how can we characterize that knotting, for example? How can we tell the difference between two different knotted versions of this cube graph? All right, so they're the sort of questions we're looking at. And the best answer we've found so far is is to adapt this notion of tight knots. Okay, so these are still very open questions. I'm just kind of throwing these topological questions out to you because there's lots of clever mathematicians there who might be able to say something. I've got another slide on here. Okay, so what sort of invariance can we find of these tangled graphs? So one approach has been to enumerate all the knots and links that are generated by cycles in the graph. Okay, so in this example here, you'd have a nice Hopf link. So there's this one here linking with that cycle there. And then there's other knots. If you follow other cycles in the graph, then you get other knots and other links. And if you look at all the knots and links from one graph and compare them with all the knots and links in a different embedding of the graph, then that is one way to tell the difference between them. But it's not the whole story. And it's not the whole story because we can get other entanglement modes which don't exhibit knotting or linking, but they're still entangled. They're not ambient isotopic to the straight Y vertex. Okay, and we've called these types of structures ravels, but I think they are because Stephen and Toen kind of rediscovered them when they were studying these knotted objects. But I think they have been known to mathematicians in the past. Other people have studied them. So this example of a raveled node, if we stick a node with this type of entanglement into a graph, then it doesn't introduce any different knots or links, okay? So if we took a cube and we just replaced one vertex with a ravel like this, and we looked at all its knots and links, they would still be the same as the regular cube, okay? All right. So the best, well, the kind of the working solution that we're using at the moment is to adapt this concept of an ideal or a tight knot. So the idea behind that is to take, imagine your knot is made out of a physical piece of rope, so you've got a fixed diameter there, and you try and pull that knot as tight as possible. And it will reach a kind of minimal energy configuration. You can look at the length of the knot. The ratio of the length of the knot to its diameter is a measure of the complexity of the knot. And there's been, you know, computational algorithms written to compute tight configurations of knots. So they give you a way, a kind of ground state for the knot. So Miss Evans, who is a PhD student, managed to adapt that algorithm to graphs, for example. So this is a tight configuration for this knotted cube. That's just its kind of skeleton, so you can see what's going on. And this is a tight configuration of the other graph. So you can see, hopefully, that from these tight configurations that they have a different embedding in space, and so the idea is that the different tight configurations are distinct, so they represent different knotted nets. Okay, so if we now look at the hyperbolic plane, we can go, this is our Poincaré disk model of hyperbolic geometry. So in this model, straight lines in hyperbolic space are mapped to circles that meet the boundary at right angles. All right, so the circles and straight lines, the diameters that you see here are all geodesics in the hyperbolic plane. Obviously, area is highly distorted. Each of these triangles is supposed to be identical in the hyperbolic space. And we can map this hyperbolic plane onto, for example, these three triply periodic minimal surfaces. So these surfaces form a family of, this is called the P for primitive cubic, this is the geroid, and this is the D for the diamond surface. So the P and the D were known 150 years ago, and the geroid was only discovered by Alan Skern in the 50s, I believe. But they're all, these are a related family of surfaces. They all have the same intrinsic geometry, intrinsic hyperbolic geometry, but they have a different embedding in three-dimensional space. So if we take a tiling in the hyperbolic plane that has that compatible symmetry, we can map that tiling onto the surface and then look at the network of edges, and we get a three-periodic crystalline network. Okay, so so the process of enumerating all the compatible symmetries and generating tilings and the associated three-dimensional networks has been a big project that I've worked on mostly with Stuart Ramsden, and we've collated all our results on a website, EpiNet, called EpiNet, so Euclidean patterns in non-Euclidean tilings. So there's thousands and thousands of networks there. So if anyone feels like they can't sleep at night, you can go and have a little look through all these periodic tilings. All right, so the first topological question that's going to arise is, how can you tell the difference between two periodic networks? All right. And thankfully, this question has actually been answered for most situations by Olaf Delgado Friedrichs, who also did a lot of work in tiling theory, combinatorial tiling theory, with Dress and Daniel Hewson. So he came up with a canonical form for periodic nets. which is he's called SISTA for symmetry, structure recognition, and realization, so that he gets a geometric embedding. So the idea is you put each vertex at the center of weight of its neighbors, and that when you do that in an affine space and rational coordinates, you're able to compute the symmetries of that periodic network. All right, so from the barycentric placement of the vertices, he computes the symmetry group of that network and then determines the minimal translational unit cell and an ordered canonical way to write that translational unit cell. So it's a very, very clever little algorithm, and it works for all nets provided you don't have vertex collisions. So if two distinct vertices end up at the same point in your barycentric placement, then his algorithm does break down. But nets that are of interest to chemists don't tend to have that problem. So this works on a very large family of periodic nets. So he solved that single periodic network question for us. But the nice thing about the hyperbolic plane is you don't have to just look at tilings by finite bounded tiles. You can also look at tilings of the hyperbolic plane that are infinite ribbons, and their boundaries happen to be trees. Okay? So if we look at this type of pattern in the hyperbolic plane and we wrap it up onto our surface, we get, in this case, two periodic networks with degree 3 at each vertex. Chemists know this framework as Y star, or Mike O'Keefe's calling it SRS. What I'm showing here with these two examples is that with these two different, slightly different versions of that degree 3 tree in the hyperbolic plane, wrapped onto, in this case, the same surface, gives you exactly the same network in space. So these two examples both consist of a green version of Y star and a purple version of Y star. So this is green as another version of Y star with interwoven with a version of Y star, two copies of Y star interwoven with one another. The point is they're interwoven in different ways. All right, so how do we detect these different interweavings of two identical nets? So again, the best answer we've got so far is using this adapted SONO algorithm to get a tight embedding of that. And Mith wrote a beautiful PhD thesis that examined many different classes of entanglements and multi-component objects that you can get in this way. So this example here is a generalized rod packing, which is built out of kind of roughly helical filaments. This one, I think, is two periodic nets. So they're effectively a two-dimensional structure here in layers interwoven. So there's many layers that are all interwoven with one another. You can also get chainmail structures with links that are all wrapped up with one another. This is just a small piece of a much more complex structure. And here you've got three periodic trees that are entangled, also with a two periodic structure running through the middle there. So there's just this huge wealth of different types of structures that you can get out of this approach. And we're interested in any way and any ideas people might have in how to study them, describe them, and so on. So who cares about all of this? Well, as I said earlier, crystal engineers, such as Davide Prosepio in Italy, he actually builds metal organic frameworks that have some of these entanglement properties. And he with a Russian, Vladislav Blatov, have written a computer package called Topos, which is a method for describing a lot of these different entanglement modes, but I wouldn't say it's the final answer in how to describe these things. The knotted cube type stuff is of interest in DNA nanotechnology, so people like Ned Zeeman can actually build little polyhedra out of strands of DNA. I don't know if you're familiar with this work, it's quite incredible, but basically molecular engineering is at the stage now where you can dial up a strand of DNA with a particular... What the building blocks they use are, for example, a trivalent piece of DNA. So you've got a junction and then three strands of DNA with particular codes, and you stick these little trivalent things in a soup, and because of the properties of DNA, they link up together and form... You can design them, engineer them in the right way so that you can build little polyhedral cages. So they've built all sorts of different structures out of that. And if you start letting those edges get long, then you can start to see these knotted cubes as well, all right? So you don't only get just the nice compact cubes. I'm pretty sure they're also starting to get these knotted things, but they're not quite sure how to measure that yet. And there's also some nice work off on a tangent in textile engineering. So these people have actually looked at how to characterize periodic knots. So you can view a woven material or a knitted material as a periodic structure, entangled structure. If you map that into the torus somehow, then you have a periodic knot, and perhaps properties of that periodic knot can tell you something about the strength of a material. So there's a little bit of work in that direction, but lots of intriguing questions there.